Welcome, everybody, to beautiful and not-so-sunny Bel Air today, and to the Q&A for the month of April. So the floor is yours.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question from my Havruza in Idaho.
Yes.
His name is Reverend Dan Fink. He wants to know, he would like to know your thoughts about adding items to the Seder plate. He says he read a great commentary today about adding a shoelace as a reminder about what's happening on the board. And if you dislike the practice, fair enough, and if you support it, then he wants to know what your ideas are on what, if anything, we should be adding to our Seder plates this year.
All right, so the question is from Rabbi Dan Fink, who is listening in from Idaho. So, hello, Rabbi Fink. All of us at Ziegler have heard many great things about you, so keep doing the wonderful work you're doing. The question is, how do I feel about the practice of adding things to the Seder plate, and if I'm in favor of it, what things would I add? Yes? Okay. So, I am moderately in favor and moderately in opposition. The thing is, everybody tries to kidnap Passover and Hanukkah for whatever cause is their cause. So every year, any Jew who's on anyone's mailing list starts to get inundated with things you should be saying at the Seder, things you should be adding when you light the Hanukkah lights. And it becomes a kind of like theme Shabbat, where the theme is anything but Shabbat. And that makes me a little queasy. So I'm very limited as to what I add to the Seder plate. That isn't to say during the course of a Seder, you can add lots of readings, and you can certainly raise pretty much any topic you want to in the course of the discussions, but I don't like adding a whole lot to the Seder plate. I add an orange because I do, and frankly, because my Bitmoji graphic, you know, the one of me with the Seder plate has an orange on the plate anyway, so I feel like I need to live up to that. But I resist all the other add this, add that, that everybody wants us to do, in part because with very little creativity, the idea of how do you deal with refugees and people who are fleeing from a pharaoh-like existence and aspiring for freedom, I don't think that's very hard to work into the actual traditional text of the Haggadah. So I would not want to put a shoelace on my Seder plate. That doesn't feel very aesthetic. But I do like the idea of allowing the tradition to live by weaving contemporary concerns into the discussion of Passover. I don't think this is an evening for just antiquarian interest. And that's coming from a guy who has a lot of antiquarian interest. But I think it's the night that invites us to bring our contemporary struggles along with us. And since we're on the subject of Passover, I will add that I think it's really important going into it to do the work of preparation in terms of what both politically on the outside and spiritually on the inside, what are the pharaohs we're bringing with us to the table? What are the things that we need liberation from? And what are the things that our community needs liberation from? And what does our world need liberation from? And then in whose world are we pharaoh? And to whom are we needing to let them go? And that can include ourselves or parts of ourselves, too. So I think it's really important to do that kind of discernment work in advance of the Seder to be able to know what we're supposed to encounter when we're there. Others?
Now that it's almost Pesach, what are your intentions for the High Holy Days?
Well, I'm very fortunate. I have the best gig in the Jewish world. So for 20 some odd years, I've been the rabbi at Barad Hall in Sinai Temple. And we have about somewhere between 900 and 1,200 of the coolest people in Los Angeles. Cool because they love the tradition, but they don't sweat the details. And we get the most magnificent music, the most awesome chazan ever, and a great choir. So my intention is to enjoy it yet again. I will tell you that some of you in this room have experienced it already, but my personal practice is to give Yom Kippur everything I've got, and then the last hour of Ne'ilah, God hugs me through my son Jacob, who gets up on the bima and forgets his fear of crowds at that moment, and so we spend literally an hour with the open ark and the music going, and me just hugging Jacob, which means, and I'm giving you due warning, that the cantor will have to call pages again during Ne'ilah, because I won't be available. Those are my plans for the holidays. And Sukkot. Others?
I saw an interview recently with one of the presidential candidates.
Is there an election coming up?
It's in a while. I think you have time.
Okay.
And the interviewer asked about the candidate's religious inclinations and why a person who he perceives, why a candidate that the interviewer perceives as intellectual would be a person of faith and how those things go together. And I was curious how you would have answered that question.
Yeah. So the question is that a presidential candidate was asked by an interviewer who perceived the candidate to be smart, how is it you're smart and a person of faith?
Yes.
I get that question from my mother all the time. And I can say that because I know she never listens to my podcast. So if you don't tell her, she won't know we're having this conversation. I think one of the pieces of ego arrogance flying in our culture these days is that people congratulate themselves on how smart they are for being atheists, as if that's the default position for smart. That strikes me as grossly ahistorical, meaning if you trot out some of the greatest thinkers in the course of human history, and then you eliminate everybody who's got some kind of metaphysical thing going on, you're going to have a very short list of people, most of whose ideas have been outmoded. So that's not to say that religious people don't have their own form of arrogance and self-congratulations. But I don't think the universe is reducible to an IQ test. So if you're asking why would someone who is not a fundamentalist and why someone who's been exposed to Western critical thinking nonetheless chooses to address the universe in first person, meaning I thou to the universe, for me there are a couple things. One is belief in a single unified mindfulness out of which the universe emerges accounts for consciousness better than any competing explanation that I know of. The second best explanation is just in Hebrew, stam kacha, you know, meaning I don't know how it happened, it just happened. But that's actually not an explanation at all. That's an admission of utter ignorance, which is a defensible posture with the universe. You could just say we know nothing, and But that's not what the professional atheists claim. They claim to know something, and that feels close to indefensible when it comes to issues of consciousness. I think that notions of a caring God are the best explanation for why the universe slowly arcs towards justice and that things actually move. One of the things that has come to our attention is that according to most of the general laws of physics accepted today, the universe should be bubbling into a kind of sameness. And yet, at least in our corner of the universe, it's been hyper-organizing over the last 14 billion years, so that what was originally a kind of cosmic soup coalesced into galaxies and planets and organized life and self-organizing life in a way that is counterintuitive to this whole entropy thing. So I think there's a lot of puzzles that the universe keeps offering us that make plausible conflicting explanations. So I do think that to be an intelligent person of faith these days, and I want to put in the category something that will aggravate our atheist friends, and that's why I'm glad my mother's not hearing this. Someone who is a believing atheist is still believing. Like, they have a belief. So the choice of privileging one set of explanations for reality over another, I think, if you're intelligent, has to be done with some ongoing humility. All right, so the work we do is to make a tentative affirmation, which we then inhabit. But we do it remembering that it's plausible to come up with a conflicting explanation that someone also could tentatively inhabit. So I think atheists today should admit they might be wrong. There might, in fact, be a something beyond our control and description out of which this all emerges, and that something might have some of the attributes of a someone. And I think people who are self-identified as religious need to recognize that we might be wrong. It all might be a swirl of gas that means nothing. But it sure doesn't feel that way. And I know that I live better when I live with a sense of being part of a larger purpose that I experience as liberating and loving. And that has implications, and that's the next thing I want to say, is that part of the way you measure things is not a correspondence model of truth. My ideas meet something out there. It's, does it work? So what I will say is many of the people I know who are devout atheists are also people who bump their heads up against not knowing what to do when they get up in the morning. Like, in a meaningless universe, why go to work? Why have kids? Why fight for a better tomorrow? And one of the things religion gives me is resilience and purpose. Like, I know why I get up in the morning, and I know what my job is supposed to be. And here's the last thing I want to say, which is that works even if it's delusional. Like, even if I'm wrong, but I wake up in the morning committing myself to a universe of love and justice, and then I spend the day fighting for love and justice because I feel that I am a servant of the Holy One who calls me to that life, at the end of my life, if I'm wrong, I will be bitter about cracked crab and not having lard in the frijoles. I will be bitter about that. But here's the funny thing. I won't be bitter about Shabbos. I love my Shabbos observance. And I wouldn't be bitter about the holiday calendar. I love the Jewish holidays. And I wouldn't be bitter about all the Torah I've studied, because that's walked with me through all kinds of things I wouldn't have survived otherwise. So as delusions go, this is a rather glorious one. But the kicker is, it's so glorious that it makes me think it's not delusional. Like, what are the odds of a delusion working so well for so long for so many? So that puts me back in the believer camp.
I think probably the interviewer would have cut you off a long time ago, but I appreciate the longer.
And I have the mic. Yeah, that's probably why rabbis are not invited onto that show. Yeah. Others, yeah.
So one thing that I personally am struggling with going into Passover this year is thinking about, like, how we approach the holiday of Pesach and, like, the liberation story in light of the Israeli elections and a time when it feels like the Israeli government, at least for me, it feels like the Israeli government in a lot of ways is acting like Pharaoh. How do we reconcile that? Or what advice do you have for me to reconcile that?
Yeah, so I need to reclaim that talking about how do you celebrate Passover in a story of liberation when you perceive the Israeli election to be one in which a pharaoh-like character won the election is your problem, and the problem of many others who have similar convictions, but it isn't everybody's problem, right? And I also think it's more generalizable. What do you do when, well, two things I want to say. Maybe three. When I sit down for the Seder, I'm trying to enter a space in which I see the world through God's eyes and not through ours. And there, the miracle of the story of Passover is that God uses fallible human beings to bring about liberation. And we have both the advantage and the disadvantage of knowing that the story ends with an imperfect liberation. Right? They wander through the wilderness being unappreciative and imperfect, and then they wander into the land of Israel where they create an imperfect kingdom. So liberation doesn't mean, okay, we're done and now the struggle's over. It means you now get to struggle on a higher level. So for me, whatever issues I may have with the coalition that's about to start governing, it doesn't really touch the Passover story. Because my first allegiance is to this story and to the vision that it holds out, that liberation is always partial and imperfect and halting, and that's why we have to do this year after year after year. We do it again and again. Two, I don't know of a perfect government. So I know that there are governments that come closer to my political vision and they're not perfect, and I know there are governments that are further from my political vision and they're less perfect in my view. But they're none of them perfect. So I guess I want to invite all of us not to peg our ultimate allegiance to the world as it currently is. Right? Our job as Jews, I believe, is to bridge the gap between the way the world is and the way the world ought to be. Right? There's always a cosmic Torah greater than the Torah we're living. And that's pulling us in a direction. So by all means, sit around the Seder table and talk about what liberation should look like. But then here's the challenge. I have a different challenge for those on the left and those on the right. For those on the left, I'd like us to ask ourselves, why would a majority of Israeli youth vote for Netanyahu, which they did, right? And I want to rule out the argument of craziness or bigotry, because I don't think that's what it is. So I want us to try, just as every generation should make themselves see as though they themselves were personally liberated from Egypt, occupy an Israeli of your age group and ask, why do they see the world that way? And don't pathologize it. Like, ask, why would a reasonable human being see it that way? That doesn't mean at the end of the exercise you have to see it that way yourself, right? But I want you to sympathetically enter into why might that be how people see things. And then ask yourself, what can we do about that? Because that's a different answer than, well, just those people are bigots and we need to brush them aside, right? And for those on the right, I think there's a similar assignment, which is put yourself in the head of a young American Jew who's had a positive Jewish experience growing up and who what they were told about Judaism stumbles when they start hearing things about Israel's current government and current politics. And don't pathologize them right away. This isn't just they're ignorant. This isn't just, well, they have no values. This is like, honor them and enter to their headspace and ask, why are they pushed in that direction? And then what do we need to do to help them? Right? And I think if we could train ourselves to start entertaining the imagination of people whose politics is not our own, that would broaden the Passover story in ways that are really important for all of us. Others?
I'm curious if you have suggestions, either for reading or for some spiritual practice to accompany us through the counting of the Omer.
Okay, so the question is about the spiritual of the Omer and things we can be reading or doing to help us with our spiritual practice of the Omer. You have asked the one rabbi in the world who has the most counterintuitive thing to say on this subject, so I want you to just hereby state that what I say in no way represents responsible rabbis and what they would tell you if you asked them that question. So counting the Omer is a biblical practice in which sheaves of barley were brought to the temple throughout the period from Passover to Shavuot, after which one could utilize that harvest. And we counted those days, and it's become a way of linking Passover to Shavuot, the festival of the giving of the Torah, so we kind of count our way back to Sinai and back to receiving the Torah again. It has some overtones of mourning about Akiva students, most of whom would have tenure by now otherwise, so I don't think we should continue mourning them necessarily. I think we have managed to turn spirituality into a burden and an assignment. And I hate that. So other peoples, when given a spiritual opportunity, like, you know, Hindu people throw color at each other and they make pretty smells in the air and they have yummy foods. And we say, oh, I need to have a discipline for this and I need to read some books on this. And I don't like that response. What if you give yourself over during the Omer period to experiencing a different facet of liberation every day? Don't take on an additional task. Don't make it into an excessively heavy burden. Like, just say, hey, I'm alive and I get to count another day. So what am I going to do to make that joyous and to acknowledge it and to live in it? What if you take a photograph of a different beautiful plant every day of the Omer, and you have an Omer calendar, which every single day has a different flower or a different something? Right? What if you did that? Or what if you made a list of 50 things you love that you don't always make time for, and then during the course of the Omer, every day, you make sure you cross off one of those? I just want to say, reading a Brad Artson book can't be on the list more than once, all right? So you have to hold back on that, right? But if every day, something you love, go to a concert, walk outside, how about it's time of year to take your first stroll in the ocean and take off your shoes and get your ankles wet? What about walking in the hills? What about calling up a loved one who you haven't talked to in a while? How about an old friend who, it's not that you fell apart, you just kind of life drifted you away, so you're going to just have the pleasure of calling them out of the blue and saying, no reason, just wanted to hear your voice. A song you used to love to sing. A movie from your childhood that you haven't seen since you were a kid. You know, anything that Burl Ives sang in counts. Right? What if you give yourself Omer not as a, I'm going to be serious and spiritual so I can earn the Torah, but because I think God gets sick of those faces. Like, what if you just figure out a way to dance your way to Torah? So my recommendation is, don't read any extra books. And then I'll tell you the extra book I'm going to read. So I actually got someone who emailed me about this because they were so shocked. So whoever comes again, I'm going to recommend an Art Scroll publication. So Art Scroll has just come out with a translation of Avot de Rabbi Natan, which is the Talmudic tractate to Pirkei Avot. And I'm assuming it's not news for everyone here or for my learned listeners, that it's a Jewish practice to read a chapter of Pirkei Avot every Shabbat in between Passover to Shavuot. And then those of us who have a really, like a double chelek in Olam Haba, an extra spacious portion in the world to come, we keep reading a chapter of Pirkei Avot all the way through to Rosh Hashanah, right? And it fits the weeks more or less. So, but you've done Pirkei Avot again and again and again, and you should do it, but what if this year we all do it while reading Avot to Rabbi Natan, too. And so we schedule the book in such a way that we finish Avot to Rabbi Natan from Pesach to Shavuot. Right? It's an amazing, amazing collection of Agadita. And it's the rabbi's riff on Pirkei Avot. So you'll get to see a talking snake, and you'll get to see some conversations between Adam and Eve that you never experienced before, and some cool rabbinic encounters. So not that I'm saying you should do that. You can only do it if you enjoy it, but you will enjoy it. So you could put a vote to Rabbi Natan on the read during the Omer period list. Yes.
What happens
happened to our Baal Shems? Like, what happened to the people who were respected for healing in ways that nowadays are seen as kooky or woo-woo or whatever, and aren't part of our tradition? What happened to that? And where do we find it now from somebody who isn't what I'm trying to, like, there's two sides to everything, and one side I fall on and one I don't. And where are the teachers in that?
Yeah. So the question is, where are our Baal Shem Tovs? Right, miracle workers, people who are able to open up souls, where are those people? And I think we have been distanced them for legitimate and illegitimate reasons. The legitimate reason is that some of them are charlatans, and were, right? You read some of the stories of the early greats, and some of them are lovely, and some of them look stage managed, and some of them are horrific. Right, so I think the way modernity has dealt with it is just to shut down the position and to preclude the possibility. Nobody can get hurt if nobody occupies that seat. But of course, that's the wrong response, because it's true, no one can get hurt in that way, but everybody is hurt by not having access to that level of magic. So I tend to look not in the public places and not for the people who look like Baal Shems. I don't mean by that physically. I mean the people who present themselves as, you know, I am a holy person and I mediate holiness and so you should follow me. Those are the people I tend to back away from. But I know people who bring magic in their wake. And I imagine you do too. If we can strip our mind of what we expect them to look like, and we just know how we feel in their presence, and we know what their words can do for us, or what their hugs do for us, those people can be Baal Shems for us. And then I guess I'd invite us, you know, one of the things I most love about the legend of the Baal Shem Tov is that for much of his life he was hidden. Right? And so I've often thought, what would it be like if we conducted our lives as though we were hidden Baal Shem Tovs? Meaning, we look for the magic that we can make possible in the world. We look for the ways that our intuition opens doors for us. And I think part of the challenge of Western education is Western education is designed to shut down the possibility of noticing when we have intuitions beyond our grasp. So what if we resist that? What if we push on those closed doors a little bit? And we try to honor the times and the places that our own inner intuition opens up portals that were closed for us. That's the best I can do. I still don't trust self-proclaimed Baal Shem Tovs. In that sense, and only in that sense, I think the Rabbi Nachman followers have it right. Pick someone who is safely deceased and have that person be your Baal Shem Tov, because they can't betray you in the same way anymore. And then you have the capacity to fantasize what they're like rather than deal with the real one. And so I guess that's the last thing I want to say. You know, the Baal Shem Tov is still available to us. And Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu, like, these are living presences in my life. Can you open yourself to them? So all of those. I know they're not the answer. It's the best one I can give at the moment. One more?
I'm still trying to formulate this question, but I've been following the Notre Dame story. So for those who don't know, Notre Dame cathedral in Paris, this horrible fire ravaged it yesterday and destroyed it. Not the whole thing, but the majority of it. And so I'm mourning that loss too, as somebody who's visited it one time in my life, but just as a beacon and an international monument. But I'm still trying to pinpoint what really is the tragedy. it happen, because I know I feel it, but I can't necessarily articulate what it is.
Yeah.
And if you have any sort of response to that.
Okay, so so Notre Dame is an extraordinary place. And I have two conflicting emotions when I walk into Notre Dame. First thing I want to do is sit at a pew and meditate and pray. And the second is I want to throw a rock through one of the windows. Right? Any Jew who walks into the Baal Shem Tov can't help but notice that two of the statues on the front of the building are the synagogue destroyed and the church triumphant. Right? Those sons of bitches. You know, they put their anti-Semitism front and center. There's no guessing around about it. So it's a building that is in part a faith based on turning us into a fetish. And Jews died because of that fetish. So there's a piece of me that hates that building. And then once you get inside, though, and you let yourself sit for a bit, that is some spectacular building. And so part of what I think about is symbols don't only mean what they were originally intended to mean. Like, what's extraordinary about Notre Dame is that in a post-Catholic country, it continues to be the symbol of every hopeful aspiration of the French nation. And in that sense, of anyone who identifies with liberty and equality and fraternity. And so the meaning of it has morphed over the years. It's a symbol of Western hope. And in that sense, I'm a child of Notre Dame. There was a wonderful French rabbi, Delphine Horfleur, who, like, I imagine her name was given her by J.K. Rowling. And she put a thing up on Facebook in which she reached out to her Catholic friends to say, I'm sorry about what you've lost, and I also want to say that that building is also in some way mine, and I've also lost something. So in that sense, any of us who identify with the best of Western culture, we've suffered a body blow. I intend to make a contribution to rebuild it. I wouldn't mind if they left off those two chicks on the front. That'd be fine. But I'm willing to rebuild that building because of what it now stands for. It doesn't stand for now what it was built to stand for. It's no longer the church triumphant. And in that sense, the power of people to redefine a symbol is something that should be familiar to anyone who loves Midrash. Because we do that all the time. We read Bible stories against their original intention, and we present that misreading as the new reading. And Judaism is one of the rare faiths that makes that okay. In fact, encourages it. So I think that's what we've lost. You know, and I'll close with my favorite piece of music is Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Right? Which I was surprised to learn was adopted as the EU's anthem. But when the EU adopted it, they adopted the music, not the words. So it's wordless music. But the Ode to Joy is about the triumph of progress. It's about how despots fall and humanity moves towards enlightenment. And I have that as my ringphone, my ringtone on my phone, because I want to be reminded a couple times a day not to give up and that there is joy to be found. And I think Notre Dame became a similar symbol. And so that's what got assaulted. And I think that President Macron was right to say that we have to choose the destiny of rebuilding that symbol. And that will be a chance for us to come together and to assert that we don't have to be trapped by the fires that incinerate what we love. So, thanks, everybody.